Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this edition of Leak Project. I am your host, Rex Bear, and we have Deanna Spingola with us from Spingola.com. Now, she is author of several books, a three-part series of The Ruling Elite, as well as Screening Sandy Hook. In tonight's podcast, we are going to be discussing the clandestine control and hidden hand of many forms of society, alternative history viewpoints, as well as what might have happened at the Sandy Hook massacre, according to Deanna. So, enjoy the show. Make sure to subscribe to LeakProject.com. If you go to our website, you will have access to exclusive content, deals, and discounts with many of our guests' products as well. Most people that grew up during the Cold War, World War II, and previous to that have been very conditioned to believe whatever the mouthpiece on a mainstream news outlet tells them to if they follow it up with, well, the government says this. And it's very unfortunate because it's really created this, just, I guess you could say, almost ignorant society which has been so brainwashed. So the stuff that you talk about is very controversial. Like, just looking at your book title, Screening Sandy Hook, the first thing that comes to my mind is how I feel, and many others feel, that that was a staged event, that many of the people that pretended to be in that school were actually crisis actors. I mean, there's so much video footage you can see of people getting into character before they start pretend crying on these mainstream news outlets. So let's talk about, first off, I'd love to hear about where you come from and what took you down this path. If you tell our audience just a bit about yourself, and then we'll segue in from there.
All righty. Well, I try to be very objective. And of course, I grew up thinking that World War II was, oh, we went after that bad, terrible, terrible Hitler. He was murdering all of these people. And when you really look at World War II, 50 million people died. And we don't hear the real story behind World War II or World War I or, as far as that goes, the Civil War. So I cover the history in the Ruling Elite series from the Civil War, actually before the Civil War, because you have to have the lead up to the Civil War. So I covered the Civil War, World War I, and World War II in my trilogy, the Ruling Elite Trilogy.
Okay. Now, the Ruling Elite Trilogy, let's talk about that. How long did it take you to put that information together, and what did you come up with after you wrote it? Did it really kind of change the way you think?
Well, I first started writing for various websites in 2005. And I believed a lot of what was said because there are people that frame the debate. In other words, the first people out with any information about a particular event have the opportunity to frame the debate. In other words, they will disseminate what they want everyone else to believe about a particular thing. And of course, people always believe the first things that they hear rather than be objective and be critically thinking. They will just accept, oh yeah, Hitler was a bad guy. And, the Americans went, the Allies went in and they took care of everything. And now we have, what we have. And, anyway, when I first started writing in 2005, and I've actually gone back to some of my articles, and I put a message at the top and say, I don't necessarily believe the things in this article anymore because I've looked at things more critically and looked at the other side. I always, always look at the other side. I don't believe, never believe the first information that is out about a particular thing. Whether you're talking about 9/11, whether you're talking about the Civil War, World War I, World War II, or Sandy Hook. So anyway, in the end of 2008, one of a couple of publishers approached me within 2 days of each other and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book based on my articles. I have a lot of articles at Spingola Speaks, Spingola.com, and they're kind of categorized by year and by subject matter. And I thought, me, write a book? Well, I had written 2 previous books that were totally on a different topic. It's on quilting. I'm kind of a mathematician, and I guess I'm very left-brained. But anyway, I created some rather dramatic art quilts and wrote a couple books and went all over the country teaching these methods. And so anyway, when these publishers contacted me, I thought, well, okay, I guess I could put some of my article, you know, based on my articles, I could go deeper into my subject matter and write a book. And I thought that, so I started writing and writing and writing and writing. And I'm very detail-oriented. And so I kept writing and writing and writing. And I went with the first publisher because I felt, you know, that's a fair thing to do. And so anyway, about 6 weeks before the book was supposed to come out, he approached me and he said, we want you to change several things, and we want you not to use certain words. We want you to just let people use their imagination and don't be so specific about certain ethnic groups. So, you know, just we want to wait for a year. And by the way, I want to give you an assistant. And this assistant that this publisher wanted to give me had never written a book in her life. What he was saying was, I want to give you a handler so that you write what I want to publish. So I didn't think that was a very good deal. So I broke the contract. Actually, he had broken the contract before because he had not given me a check that he said he was going to give me. And he hadn't done a couple other things, so actually the contract was by default broken. So I went ahead and published myself. But the book turned into 3 books, and each of those 3 books are about 700 pages long.
I want to jump in here real quick if I can. If I'm looking at your website, and I mean, it looks like you've got, you know, just 4 really powerful books when it comes to information that you're not going to find in your typical bookstores, etc. Now, I find it fascinating that you said you had like a handler that basically, or somebody that they wanted to be your handler. You didn't allow it, but they wanted to be your handler.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out, like, was this some type of government guy, or what is your thought on this individual?
On the publisher? Now, it was the publisher that approached me first, that after he read the manuscript, after the publisher read the manuscript, he decided that I needed a handler because I wasn't writing what he thought I was going to be writing. Based on my articles, he figured that I would go along with, the typical story, things that everybody believes. Hitler was a bad guy and, you know, all of those things that people typically believe about World War II and of course World War I and the Civil War as far as that goes. And, he had some objectives, from reading my articles that he thought he would be able to fulfill with a book from me. But in my research, I research very thoroughly. I look at both sides. I'm very objective. And so after he went through scanned the manuscript, he said, oh, I want to give you an assistant, someone that had never written a book before. And actually, he wanted to give me a handler so that I would write what he wanted me to write, and I wasn't going to do that. That's just not what I do. I don't write what is popular, and accepted. I write what is true.
Imperialism, genocide, and emancipation.
Yes, right. It's kind of a lengthy title, but it did come out April 12th, 2011. And it talked about Lincoln's war and that it was really a false flag. It was unnecessary, a completely, completely unnecessary war. But what it did was it changed the entire, it changed the South. It changed, states' rights. It changed a lot of things. And what it did most of all was that it federalized, it gave power to a central government. So, the states lost many of their rights and, government became centralized, federalized, and it grew from there. Grew bigger and bigger and bigger from there.
Where is it now? Like, where are we right now as far as the current state of affairs? Do you feel that there's going to be possibly martial law that could take place at any time?
I would be speculating if I said that. I think that by default, we're probably already living under martial law since 1933. So, you know, I don't want to speculate. Because that's just not the way that I operate. But, just the things that occurred during the Civil War and the amendments that were put into place afterwards, like the 14th Amendment. Well, first you had the 13th Amendment, which was, decimated during the War of 1812. But after the, so-called Civil War, it was not a Civil War. When you look at the so-called Civil War, you have to recognize where the battles were fought. And in a typical war where one side, where there are two sides, you had the North invaded the South. There were only two battles that took place in the North. So that tells you quite a lot about who was the aggressor in that war. And it certainly wasn't the South. They didn't want to fight. They did everything they possibly could to avoid a conflict. And Lincoln would not meet with the Southern diplomats who wanted to come up and talk about how they could avoid this, avoid conflict, avoid any kind of problem. But Lincoln would not meet with them. And so that's why we had a war, and it was absolutely, absolutely done on a false flag technique. It was false flag. For instance, all of the forts were owned by the states. Fort Sumter was never, never under the jurisdiction of the federal government. And I mean, it's a lengthy, going through all of this, how it started, the war, the scorched earth policy that was developed during the so-called Civil War. That was the same kind of scorched earth policy, that was used by the Soviets in World War II, but it was developed by Lincoln. And he wasn't trying to get everybody together. He was really a great divider. And the war was never about slavery. The idea that they should fight about slavery did not occur until a year after the war began. The people up North would never have gone to war over slavery. And not only that, but the Union, actually slavery began in the North. And there were slaves in the North. A lot of the people who were fighting in, a lot of the generals who were fighting in the war on the Union side owned slaves. But they were not compelled to release those slaves at the end of the war. This was something that they were only going to obligate the South to do.
So then what exactly was the Civil War started upon then? Just money and control?
It was about money. It was about control. And I talk about, in the book, I talk about banking. I talk about the Rothschilds. I talk about their gold operations. I talk about the Bank of the United States. And the South was actually a colony of the North. You know, the South did not do any marketing of they did not engage in mercantilism. Whatever they wanted, they went through, people in the North. So, it was kind of like a colony.
Well, and what is the scorched earth, Paul? I've never heard that term before.
Oh, okay. The scorched earth policy. Sherman, when he was marching to the sea, he burned everything in his path. They destroyed. Oh, this is terrible what they did. They destroyed everything in their path. They destroyed food production. They destroyed animals. They destroyed barns that were filled with produce that had already been harvested. They destroyed everything in their path so that there was nothing left, so that the people couldn't eat. I mean, people were starving. They destroyed puppies and dogs and everything in their path. They destroyed it. And that was called a scorched earth policy. And that is it was a war of extermination. The Union was intent on driving all the Southerners into the sea like swine. And that is what Sherman said. His war objectives was the extermination of both soldiers and citizens.
So who controlled the North then? The Rothschilds? And that's how the war started, because they wanted to get rid of the greenback that Lincoln had? I've heard that theory before.
Just the greenback, that's a farce too.
Okay. Tell us about it.
But there were Rothschild operatives in the South also. To rile things up. But the greenback, let me find some notes on the greenback, because it's a very detailed situation. And the greenbacks, did not, you know, they say, oh, they were usury free and this was wonderful. But, let me just find my notes here. But anyway, the scorched earth policy. I mean, if you've ever seen Gone with the Wind, the movie.
You know, I haven't seen that in ages, but I think I know what you're going to reference as far as that movie goes. Just you're talking about the war at that time and how people had to flee where they were at.
Yeah, I mean, they burned the South. They burned everything. They burned it all. So, anyway, there was as far as the greenbacks, let's see. The Union paid their soldiers with interest-free treasury notes authorized by Congress on July 17th, 1861 for $50 million. These notes circulated at par with gold. When the Union needed additional financing, the government negotiated with New York's Rothschild financiers, who offered Lincoln a high-interest $150 million loan. However, Lincoln's advisors suggested that the government issue its own interest-free money to fund the war rather than incur debt. So Congress enacted a bill to issue $150 million full legal tender for every debt in the United States. It passed the House of Representatives in February of 1862. There was one stipulation. The congressmen who actually represented the bank's interest permitted the issue of greenbacks only if individuals could convert the bills into bonds. And this convertibility feature would allow the bankers and their agents to enact legislation which would authorize the redemption of the bonds into specie, in other words, regular money. So Congress passed the Revenue Act of 1861 on August 5th, 1861, and it was an act to provide increased revenue for imports to pay interest on the public debt, but this greenback thing, it did not come without a tax, and to facilitate, okay, let's see. Let me read this to you. This Revenue Act of 1862, which Lincoln signed, introduced the first progressive rate income tax in the country. And it was an act to provide the internal revenue to support the government and pay interest on the public debt. Now, if you're looking at the amount of money that the government owed before the war and the amount of money that was owed after the war, it is absolutely amazing. And I don't have those figures in front of me. But what the war did was increase debt.
So, okay, because there's so much speculation that that's one of the reasons the Civil War was started, because, Lincoln wasn't playing ball with the Rothschild control.
Oh, but he was.
He was, okay.
He was. Oh, he absolutely was. And, in fact, he made a lot of money. He made a lot of money because he was a railroad lawyer, and he knew where the railroad was going to be built, so he bought land right along where the railroad was. And if you really, people think, oh, Andrew Jackson, he routed out the bankers. No, he did not. No, he did not. He worked a special deal with the Rothschilds of London to be the correspondent bank for the United States. Okay? And this myth that he rounded out the bankers is just that. It is a myth. But it is popular. So if it's popular, people are going to believe it. They're not going to look at the actual records. They're not going to look at anything that occurred during that time. They're just going to believe the myth. The popular, whatever is popular is what people are going to accept. And it doesn't even need to be true. But he was a slave owner. He was a planter. His Indian policies were horrific. Because of his policies, a lot of the tribes that lived in the South were shifted out to make room for plantations. And those plantations were often acquired by people from the North, Jackson's friends. And so Jackson's friends came down and became plantation owners. And a lot of the slave owners, only about 5% of the people in the South owned slaves. And many of the slave owners were just small time farmers, and the owners, the would work right alongside the slaves, and it wasn't as depicted as it was recently in Roots. There was a, four-part series last week, I believe. And that was, well, it does not depict what actually happened. But, yeah, Jackson and the Rothschilds were very chummy. And Jackson was a fiscal, or the Rothschilds were the fiscal agents for the government of the United States because of Jackson. And because of Jackson, we had the first real big financial crises in 1837. Had it not been for his policies and his financial planning, there never would have been the 1837 crises, and a lot of the people who owned land lost their land. And they were really mad. They were really mad. And a group of them approached Jackson, and he would not listen to them all he did was just basically ignore them, and he did what he wanted to do. It's all in my book.
Now, was that most of that in your first book that we're talking about?
Or? All of the things that we've already we've discussed are all in my first book.
Okay, so that's kind of getting more into the, I guess you could say, Civil War time, the really old school early foundations of the U.S.
Well, you have to realize that the early foundations of the U.S. aren't as traditional as people think they are.
George Washington told a lie?
He actually did.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
He really did. But, I mean, there was propaganda, and I talked about the propaganda. Now, in Europe in 1848, there was the Marxist Revolution. It took place there was an attempt at a revolution in several places, countries in Europe. They were not successful. So, excuse me. So, there's about 500,000 of these Marxists that relocated to America. And guess which side they fought on?
Both.
The Union. The first successful Marxist revolution in the world took place in America, and it is called the Civil War. But it was a Marxist revolution. And the socialists that came over are the people that actually guaranteed Lincoln the 1860 election.
Let's get into the assassination then. Do you have any details on why he was taken out?
I do talk about this. The let's see. Let's see. It's very interesting. His son kind of played a part in that. And let's see. Let me just look at my notes. You don't want to talk about the Fort Sumter?
Well, if you have some information that you feel is important, let's get into that. Absolutely.
Okay. Because Fort Sumter, as I mentioned, all the forts actually belong to the states. And so when you're talking about this attack, the states and the federal government co-owned in equal partnership forts located in each of the states. And the federal government functioned as the general agent, and each state constructed a fort or forts for that state's exclusive protection. Now, if a state withdrew from the Union for whatever reason, that state automatically acquired the ownership of any forts within the state. In 1805, South Carolina ceded territory in Charleston Harbor only on stipulation that the central government repair or replace the existing facility within 3 years. And the central government failed to do that. And so Fort Sumter was, it was owned by the state. Now, it's very interesting when you're talking about any war, is that you're always going to have some Freemasons involved. And, the South, let's see, Major Robert Anderson. He was a West Point graduate. He was also a Winfield Scott protege, moved his 126-man garrison from Fort Moultrie to Fort Sumter, just arbitrarily. And he moved his group over there to start a problem, to begin a problem. And so what happened was that during the war, Lincoln invoked executive privilege, and he refused to give the War Department certain dispatches he had sent to Anderson. And he was complicit with Anderson in starting a problem so that it would cause the federal government to send help. And isn't that kind of what is happening all over? The federal government has created ISIS. They create these terrorist groups that start problems, and this obligates the federal government to go in and take care of the problems. Right? I mean, they created Al-Qaeda, so they had to go in and take care of the problems. And that is exactly what they did with at Fort Sumter. Lincoln and Anderson were complicit in starting, trying to get a response from the South. And it did have, you know, there were Freemasons available, but what Lincoln did was he gathered up, he was supposed to send military supplies and reinforcements and food, although they were buying their food from local merchants. But he said, oh, we're going to send some food and some reinforcements to the fort. And so Lincoln really initiated the war against the South because he sent ships down there, not only with supplies, but with military. And it was supposed to be a big secret, but he did send a group down there, and they attacked. And you know what? Nobody died at Fort Sumter. Nobody died. But that was the event that started the Civil War, and it was the event that Lincoln planned. Interesting, huh?
It is, and it's really neat when you can connect these dots and put some of this stuff together. I've heard before that our military knew about the attacks in Pearl Harbor, or they knew that there would be an attack there before it happened.
Oh, absolutely, and I cover that in my third book. Absolutely. They monitored the procession of the Japanese from the time they left Japan, both Churchill and Roosevelt, who also were in the same position of power during World War I. They were both associated with the Navy. And they were now president or prime minister of their respective countries. They monitored the Japanese all the way to Pearl Harbor. And the reason that they allowed that, they provoked it. And they provoked it by sanctions, is so that they could get, the U.S. into World War II. Because Japan and Germany had an agreement. They were buddies. They had signed an agreement that if one was attacked, then the U.S. then could say, oh gosh, Japan is attacked, so we get to attack Japan, and we also get to attack Germany. And that's how they got to that, the U.S. into World War II in Europe and, of course, in the Pacific.
Do you have information on the possibility of there being select family lines that were involved in banking oil, the military-industrial complex, et cetera, that actually funded the wars on both sides?
Are you talking about World War II?
Yes.
Okay. There is also mythology associated with that. And some people say, oh, yes, Hitler was funded by the Rothschilds. Oh, he was a Rothschild. That is mythology, and I cover that in book 3 of my trilogy. I tell where the funding came from, and yes, of course, there were companies that were doing business with German companies before World War II. And keep in mind also, well, I don't keep in mind, but England was after Germany as early as 1907 because Germany was, they didn't want competition from Germany. But Germany did not exploit her colonies. When they had an association with another country, it was always both sides benefited. In other words, they were going to build a railroad from Berlin to Baghdad. This was going to help both countries. Germany was not exploitive, whereas if you look at British colonies, they go in, they look at all the resources, they exploit the resources, kill the residents, or enslave them to work in their diamond mines or whatever they, whatever resources are available in each country. I mean, look at India, what the British did there, which I cover in my trilogy.
I was actually referring to Prescott Bush, Bush
oh, yes.
Senior's dad. I heard that he was actually involved in funding both sides of the war, but I don't have.
He didn't fund both sides of the war. Now that came from a book. Let's see if I can just grab it off my, the information that you're talking about came from a book called Trading with the Enemy, The Nazi American Money Plot, 1933 to 1949. It's written by Charles Higham, who is very, very, very biased. And, this is also the kind of nonsense that you have, now that somehow the Nazis have taken over the United States government. But this is a book that it came from. And you need to understand that in 1933, there was a economic warfare they declared economic warfare against Germany. A certain group of people declared economic warfare. And, so, in 1933, Germany had no gold. Their country was in a total disaster from World War I. And it was really, World War I and World War II, were actually one revolution with a respite in between. But when you look at what happened to, at the end of World War I, where the Allies at Versailles said, if you do not, they had sanctions against Germany. They would not allow any food into Germany. And they continued those sanctions for 9 months after the Germans signed the Versailles Treaty. Millions of people died during World War I and after World War I. And, so they were really blackmailed, not blackmailed, but, obligated to sign a treaty that was very unfair, that took land away from them, that they never should have taken. And Germany never wanted to engage in World War I. So this isn't something that started with Hitler and World War II. This was something that was ongoing from early 1900. Actually, it really goes back to, well, back to the first Marxist revolution. And when we're talking about Rothschild, you need to understand that the Rothschilds developed both communism and capitalism, because they both accomplish the very same thing. They both allow a very, very small minority to exploit the majority and have most of the wealth.
So, you know, let's talk about that for a minute. Most of the wealth. I've heard that there's basically several factions around the world that kind of have the majority of the clout of the banking system. You can go back to ancient Persia, where they actually founded banking, at least what I've heard. And then the Rothschilds kind of started later on out of France. Is that correct? Where they kind of migrated? They changed their name actually from Bayer to Rothschild.
Didn't.
Is that correct?
Nope, they did not.
Okay.
That is another myth.
You're saying a lot of stuff that's completely opposite for many of the people that I've talked to. So this is very interesting.
Yes, that is a myth. Their name was never Bauer, ever. They did live in a house with another family called Bauer, but their name was never Bauer. Their name came from the sign that was hung in front of their shop. They were shopkeepers, as many Jewish people are. They were money changers, but I do cover that myth in my first book. I talk about the Judengasse, the ghetto, where it all started. And I give a lot of early information about the Rothschilds and how they managed to change things, how they managed to become unghettoized. And it was Germany who first allowed them emancipation, which is, you know, the title of my first book. I talk about emancipation. And that emancipation, of course, was what was allowed to the Jews and what happened thereafter. But I do talk about the Rothschilds. In fact, the whole first section, the banking and industrial elite, and how banking was conceived, and how Mayor Rothschild, who was the merchant of Judengasse, how he evolved, and how his son Nathan evolved, and how they took over gold operations, how they got into globalism and banking, how they made New York City the center of mercantilism. So I talk about that.
Now, is London the financial capital of the world with the research that you've done?
The city of London, yes.
Okay, yeah, the city of London. And then America, the United States of America, a lot of the research that I have dived into points to it being a corporation somewhat under the crown. And I'm wondering if you've been able to get any connections with that or if there's any reference points there.
The United States is a corporation. The president of the United States is the chairman of the board. And I've got a lot of records that talk about that. And the president of the chairman of the board is also in charge of let's see, let me bring up this record. Well, I don't want to get into that, but it is a corporation. And that corporatocracy started and was provoked or allowable because of the so-called Civil War. Let me give you the little background about the Rothschilds. Excuse me. Ashkenazi Jews of the Germanic states, not legal citizens with surnames, adopted names associated with their houses or shops. People can trace the Rothschild name back to the ancestor Isaac, I-Z-A-A-K, son of Elkanon, as noted on his tombstone. And I give resources. I cite the resources right at the bottom of the page. Now, he lived in the Frankfurt ghetto in a house at the more affluent end of Judengasse, which is Jew's Alley, from which he had derived his name, Zum Roten Schild, at the sign of the Red Shield. The family retained the name when they relocated years later to another house, the Hinterfan. They shared the dark and dreary three-story, 900-square-feet house with the Bauer family, along with their respective businesses. And I give resources.
Yeah, that's interesting because I had never heard that before. And I'm wondering data that you got that from, or the sources that you obtained that, was that something that you can verify? I mean, is it real credible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You have to read a lot of books. And the book that this information came from is Founder, A Portrait of the First Rothschild and His Time by Amos Elon, E-L-O-N, Viking Press, New York, 1996, pages 24 and 27. Also, The Rise of the House of Rothschild by Egon Caesar Corti, translated by Brian and Beatrix Loon, Grosset and Dunlop, New York, 1928, page 3. I have, just for that information, I have five citations.
Okay.
And I give where they lived, where Meyer was born in a dilapidated tenement on February 23rd, 1744 in the Jewish ghetto, home to about 2,500 Jews. He was the fourth child. He was fourth of eight children of Shanky and Amshel Moses Rothschild, a money changer and traveling merchant who later accompanied by the very astute mayor, often sold beads and trinkets to the servants at the castle of the Landgrave, which is the landlord. I go right to the sources.
Okay. So, I mean, it sounds like you've done a whole bunch of history research into some of the older wars, you know, World War II, the big players behind the scenes. Then you've got some really interesting reference points that most people haven't heard about that have done this kind of research, at least that I know of, when you talk about the names and such of the Rothschild and where it actually originated from. Now, how far out do you go? Let's say, for example, do you talk about the Gulf Wars? Do you get into Vietnam or any of the more recent proxy wars that have been going on, like the War on Terror?
I have not written a book about the Vietnam War. Let's see. I briefly mention it. I've written articles about the Vietnam War. I have all the notes prepared to publish on the Vietnam War. But I briefly mention it. I talk about the war in the Philippines and how they used smallpox vaccine when the U.S. government invaded the Philippines, which they did invade in 1898. They demanded to inoculate everyone in the Philippines with smallpox vaccine. The Philippines was virgin. They had never had a case of smallpox. But as a result of the U.S. military going in with the backing of Big Pharma, then they had three huge epidemics, which I talk about in book two, I believe.
You know, let's jump into Sandy Hook, because you wrote a whole book about it, and there's so much out on the web that I'm sure is disinformation and a lot of legit information. What is your take on Sandy Hook, and why did you decide to actually write a book on it?
Well, I invited a couple of people that were talking. Excuse me. My allergies are just giving me fits here.
Oh, no problem.
I invited a couple of people that were talking a lot about Sandy Hook to be on my program to talk about it. And the one individual who came out with a video, she declined. She said that I want to quote her accurately, but she said, I didn't know the material well enough. And I thought, know the material long enough? What material? There's material that I need to know about. So she declined. So I decided that I would look at her video and critique it, because that's, you know, I wanted to learn the material. If I didn't know the material, I wanted to see what the material was so I would know. Anyway, so I decided that I would do a critique on the video, which I did, and I published it. If you visit my website, spingola.com, and you click on Deanna's Sandy Hook Research, it will take you to a critique of the video, part 1, 2, and 3, which I posted in February and March of 2014. And then a company said, well, gosh, why don't you write a book? And I said, okay. And this sounds like a repeat of the first story. So I said, yeah, I'll write a book. So I discontinued my critique after 3 parts and started working on a book. And I was about 2 months later, they said, oh, you know what? We really don't want to publish a book on Sandy Hook. And that was because there was so much information out there that my information would not be compatible with. And so popular opinions were more important than actually looking at the facts. Now, you mentioned, or you referred to, somebody called Robbie Parker. And you said, you know, and keep in mind that press conference was conducted by CNN/CIA. And so when you look at the CNN press conference, that Robbie Parker, he came out of his church there in Newtown, where he had been meeting with fellow members of his church. So he came out and he gave a 20-minute press conference. But they only selected 27 seconds of that press conference. And then they put little titles above that and put out a video. And the press conference took place on the 15th, December 15th. And the day after the situation, the shootings. And, but they only used, as I said, 27 seconds because, and it was a CNN person, most likely, who decided to film this or film this, just this little section and throw it out there to frame the debate, to frame the debate. Oh, he is an actor. Robbie Parker is an actor. And so then you had other people who were also framing the debate. In other words, putting out the information that people would remember and believe. And if you look at my part 1, part 2, part 3 critiques, I pretty much tear the video up. And talk about, you know, they talk about, oh, Christmas trees. There were only just so many Christmas trees. Well, no. The firehouse sold Christmas trees, had an annual Christmas tree sale for the last 13 years. But anyway, I did do a book, it's called Screening Sandy Hook, and I talk about Big Pharma. And it's a 600-page book. I talk about how children are damaged from almost day one and how vaccines are used to really make people sick. In fact, the first chapter is called Political Protocols and the Inoculation of Disease. And I talk about the FDA the transformation of the FDA. I talk about the FDA Modernization Act of 1997 and about how Big Pharma would like to have everyone on psych drugs, which, in fact, one of the leaders, one of the presidents of, hang on, I want to bring up this quote. One of the presidents of Merck said, he said, in 1975, Henry Gadsden, the head of Merck, one of the world's largest drug companies, told Fortune magazine that he wanted Merck to be more like chewing gum maker Wrigley's. It had long been his dream to make drugs for healthy people so that Merck could sell to everyone. His dream now drives the marketing machinery of the most profitable industry on earth. Drug companies are systematically working to widen the very boundaries that define illness, and the markets for medication continually grow ever larger. You know, there are children under the age of 12 months who are on antipsychotic drugs.
Are you kidding me?
Nope. And did you know that all of the shootings from 1991, from the time that they introduced Prozac, most of the shooters have been on psych drugs?
I did know that they've been on psychotropic drugs, yes, but I didn't know that they were prescribing 11-month-olds Zoloft. I mean, that's insanity.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Well, I guess, you know, just add that with the 57 vaccines and all that stuff full of thimerosal and squalene and who knows what else they're putting in it. Half of the stuff's
right.
Made in China now. Why don't you add some melamine in there, folks? I mean, come on.
Yep. But, if you are the CIA, and remember that CNN, well, okay, Anderson Cooper he was an intern for the CIA. Then he became, you know, he's on CNN. And he had a great big part in introducing the idea that Sandy Hook was a hoax through his television program. And I have that in my book.
Can I stop you real quick?
Sure.
And I'm not trying to interrupt. I'm so sorry. But are you telling me that you don't think Sandy Hook was a staged event?
I know that it wasn't.
Oh, okay. You know that it wasn't a staged event.
I know that it wasn't a staged event. And the people who came out with the first information were framing a debate that only protects Big Pharma. The only benefactor in this situation is Big Pharma. I know all the videos out there. I know that, James Fetzer has put out a lot. And, Dr. Fetzer has, challenged me to a debate. And I said, I would love to debate you. And here are my parameters. Here are my conditions to debate you. We each get 25 questions. We may choose 20 questions to answer from our respective books. His book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which was taken off of Amazon, not because it was true, but because it was full of copyright violations. Horrific, horrific copyright violations, which I write about at screeningsandyhook.net. I write about those copyright violations and why it was taken off of Amazon.
You know, I've got to say, I haven't heard that theory before about how, you know, this thing was set up to look like a staged event to protect big pharma, because if you look at a lot of the people that are in the different clips, you will see those same people on different events when you look at the James Holmes event that took place and stuff. So,
well, I've talked about James Holmes, and I've also talked about the crisis actors. And there have been a lot of people, let's see, who's that guy, Goldbug. He came out with this theory that there are crisis actors he accused me of being the same person as was on Saturday Night Live, Victoria Jackson, which is ridiculous. He makes a lot of statements, but he came out right before Sandy Hook, or seemingly so, and talked about how crisis actors were used. But most of that has been refuted. But the people who are doing the refuting do not get invited for airtime. I've only talked about Sandy Hook on probably, I could count on one hand the number of times I've talked about Sandy Hook on somebody else's radio program. And Hal Big. Hal Big is a big, he gets a lot of airtime. And I've talked a lot about Hal Big. In fact, I just finished writing a story or an article about Hal Big at ScreeningSandyHook.net. And Fetzer introduced Hal Big as an expert. He was a school security expert, nationally known. However, nobody had ever heard of the guy until his association with Sandy Hook in February of 2014. The fact of the matter is, and they say, oh, he's a former Florida State Trooper. He didn't make it past the probationary period. He did not make it past the probationary period. I have talked with people who actually worked in law enforcement in Florida, email me and talk to me about Hal Big. He says that he was a customs inspector. He said that he was, he makes all kinds of claims that are really very deceptive. So, but he was introduced as their expert because, well, he can spin a good tale.
So you think that the James Holmes event that happened at that Aurora Theater was also, you don't think that was staged or any type of false flag? Do you feel that that was also a cover-up for Big Pharma then?
I have not studied that event. I've not studied the Tucson event, but I do know that in the book, in Fetzer's book, the one that he edited, that they used cropped pictures. They used selective pictures from the final report. And I'm doing an article right now about, called Sandy Hook Was Open and Functioning. They say, oh, it was closed in 2008. They're using the Wayback Machine and saying, well, there was no activity from 2008 to 2012. Well, that was because the IT guy put the robot.txt into the website. In other words, that states that the Wayback Machine or any other robot cannot crawl their website. And if you use if you believe that, and that is what they say is their most compelling evidence, that Sandy Hook was closed from 2008 to 2012. That's their most compelling evidence. Well, if you use that as evidence, none of the schools in Newtown were open because that same robot.txt message was put into all of the school websites. And if you really want to get technical, the schools that that Halbig was working at also had big periods where the Wayback Machine did not crawl their website. So does that mean that Halbig was involved in some sort of setup to have a false flag or some kind of an event at his school just because the Wayback Machine was not allowed to crawl the websites of the two schools that he was working with?
See, what I find interesting as far as the evidence, in my opinion, that would point to it being a possible false flag or a staged event is when you look at a lot of the video footage that's released, you'll see the same players, at least they look very, very, very similar, whether it be the principal, the supposed principal of Sandy Hook, and then she looks like the lawyer of James Holmes, and then you see...
Just because two people have brown hair and they have brown eyes and two ears and two noses does not mean that they're the same people.
I didn't say that.
No, I understand.
Okay. I guess this is completely different of what I thought that book was actually going to be about, but it's interesting. You know, I mean, this is another theory to look at, and that could possibly be the reason that all of this conspiracy stuff is out there. Is that enough to convince me? Absolutely not, but, you know, I'm agnostic on the subject, and this is, you know, definitely something else to take a look at, so...
Well, I would be very happy to send you a PDF copy of my book on Sandy Hook.
I tell you, that would probably be the best thing because I would have to see a lot of very compelling evidence to say that that was not set up and staged. And you know what? You could be right. I mean, I am trying to be as open-minded about this as possible, but to see the same players in many of these events take place, and not just because they have the same color eyes and hair, by any means would I say that that's why I have that opinion. But yeah, send it to me, guestbookings@leakproject.com. I mean, we've been contacting each other, and that'd be...
Yeah, I'll just do it via Skype right now.
Cool, okay.
Doing it right now. And there's also some fabulous websites, excuse me, that discuss Adam Lanza's background, his internet appearance, presence, also his obsession with Columbine. I mean, this guy was a monster. He was a monster.
Do you think that there was some control behind the scenes pushing these people to do these events, like some type of MK Ultra handlers or somebody putting some triggers and stuff? Because if you look at some of these people, you look at their eyeballs when they get picked up, they look like they're blasted out of their minds on some type of CIA pixie dust.
Well, James Holmes, I did do an article at Screening Sandy Hook where I did talk about James Holmes. He was on psych drugs, as was the guy, the Tucson gentleman. What was his name? Lawton. He was on drugs. When you look at the shooters, these people were on drugs. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They were on drugs or withdrawing from drugs. And the other thing that you have to recognize is that the medical examiner, the state medical examiner, Dr. Carver, would not release the medical report for Adam Lanza. And the assistant attorney general for the state met in a FOIA conference. And he said that, and his name is Quancy, and he said, if we release those records, there will be some people who will not take their drugs. I mean, you have to look at everything. And yes, I do understand that there's a lot of information out there. And there's been a lot of information out there from the first minute that CNN taped Robbie Parker, and all the information, it says that it's a hoax. And as I said, the people who have studied this intently are not asked to be on any radio programs. They do make videos, and I can also send you some websites that you can look at. So there's always two sides. I mean, we all grew up believing that Hitler and Germany were the aggressors in World War II. Believed it with all our hearts. But that didn't happen to be the case.
Yeah, truth certainly is stranger than fiction sometimes. And, yeah, I appreciate you coming on the show. Folks, check out Spingola.com. You're going to have access to these PDF books. Looks like it's only 10 bucks. I mean, that is very cheap compared to the amount of information that's on there. And it looks like you're also on Twitter, on YouTube, and are you on Facebook as well?
No. 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 I didn't want to make my family vulnerable to any kind of situation. So I did have a Facebook page, and then I thought, oh, gosh, this is getting out of hand. And so I don't have a Facebook page.
I don't blame you. Absolutely. The only reason I've got a Facebook page is for the Leak Project. And, you know, why give everybody all the information about you, what you had for dinner, where you're going on vacation, when you're home,
exactly.
When you're not.
Oh,
you like.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Here's all my info. Take it and give it to everyone.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Well, right on. I appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I mean, if this is what you believe, I certainly appreciate that. And I do believe that you believe it. And hey, you know, maybe there's somewhere in the middle where it's right. Maybe you're 100% accurate. Who knows? I mean, that's the beauty of the Leak Project is we have guests from all over the world to give their opinions. And I appreciate you giving us yours and the testimony and information that you have. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I do want to let our listeners know, too, if they want to check out your radio show. I know you've got it going on. I think you said once a week. Could you give our listeners that information, too, again, please?
Right. It's at RBN, and it is on Saturday, and it is from 3 to 6 p.m. in the afternoon. And that is at republicbroadcasting.org.
Cool. Right on. Okay. Fantastic. And folks, I'd also like to recommend you check out the leakproject.com. We've got over 200 full featured podcasts with a plethora of information. Be the change you want to see. This is Rex Bear. Good night.